J. Michael Bailey. The Mysterious End of Benjamin Boyd. At the height of empire, in 1841, the Scottish-born aristocrat and adventurer Benjamin Boyd set sail for Australia in his schooner, the Wanderer, commissioned by the British government to establish the Royal Bank of Australia. Laden in the hold of his ship was £1 million in gold, equivalent of £40 million in today's money. Provided a unique chance to establish a lasting legacy as one of the greatest early founders of modern Australia, Boyd instead squanders his opportunities when 7 years later he becomes a fugitive from the law, hunted throughout the Pacific by the Royal Navy. Sailing across the Pacific in an attempt to restore his fortunes in the California goldfields, Boyd then sails for the Solomon Islands in a failed attempt to proclaim a republic with the intention of naming himself as head of the state. But without achieving his intended goals, he then mysteriously disappears and is never heard from again. Rumours abound he had been eaten by cannibals or had returned to England incognito, whilst other stories suggested he died 30 years later on the shores of the Caribbean. Now, 175 years later, he will be forever remembered as a slaver, fraudster, thief, and murderer, and a man without a grave. This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, businesses, events, and incidents are either the products of the author's imagination or used in a fictitious manner. Any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, or actual events is purely coincidental. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced in any form or by any means without the prior permission of the publisher and author. Benjamin Boyd as a young man in Scotland. Prologue. Benjamin Boyd was born in London around 1801. No official birth certificate exists to establish this with any absolute certainty. Parish records of his birth also neglect specific details at a time when his family was divided between their family home in Waterloo Place, just off Pall Mall in London, and Merton Hall, which was their family ancestral home located on the Boyd Estates in the southwest of Scotland. Records that do exist indicate Benjamin's early years were uneventful, yet relatively happy. When in residence at Merton Hall, much of his time was spent enjoying and socialising with his large extended family, who were living on the estates or villages nearby. Benjamin and members of his closer immediate family, whenever residing in London, ran an organised and busy household. Their doors remained always open to many business acquaintances and friends, as well the numerous relatives from Scotland who desired to sample a brief taste of life in what was the greatest city in the world. Whilst splitting his time between Merton Hall, near Newton Stewart, in Wigtownshire, and London, Benjamin developed a close sense of loyalty towards his family, including his associations with numerous first and second cousins, various uncles and aunts, and an assortment of other even more distant relatives residing in Scotland. Benjamin was an aristocrat, the second son of five boys in a Scottish landowning family and descendants of the Earls of Kilmarnock. A family home in the world's foremost commercial centre was therefore imperative in these rapidly changing times when Benjamin's father, Edward Boyd, due to the rise of the Industrial Revolution, had to be close to the commercial pulse of the country. With the many enterprises Edward had invested in to subsidise Merton Hall, it was essential to have a seat at the centre of empire, particularly when agriculture from the estate and rents of tenant farmers no longer provided an adequate income. Mark Sprott was Benjamin's maternal uncle and was a major influence in Benjamin's life as he reached manhood, by which time Mark was both extremely wealthy and powerful in business circles. This was fortuitous because by the time Benjamin turned 29, his father, Edward, had been declared bankrupt after a number of disastrous investments, notably in shipping and insurance, in a desperate attempt to restore the family fortunes. As a result, Merton Hall was left a desolate ancestral pile of stone, while all the movable items from it and the house in London were carried away by the bailiffs to be sold at auction. Edward's eldest son, William Sprott Boyd, had already left for India in 1819 as an official of the East India Company, leaving Benjamin Boyd and his brother Mark, who were called upon to restore the family fortunes. It was in 1825 when Benjamin became a member of the London Stock Exchange, where 2 years later Mark joined him as his clerk. Then, in the 1830s, the two brothers followed their father into the insurance business as resident directors of the Edinburgh-based North British Insurance Company with a branch office in London. It took 7 years for the brothers to slowly reverse their fortunes until Merton Hall was once again furnished and habitable. What drove Benjamin to become a ruthless murderer and immoral businessman that he did is still very much open to conjecture. It could very well have been a drive instilled in him from the time his father declared bankruptcy, leaving his 7 sons and 3 daughters and the remainder of his family edging towards the possibility of abject poverty. Whoever Benjamin became in his efforts to restore their finances, he regardless quickly proved his loyalty to his entire extended family in his determination to regain what had been lost by his father. But the process of achieving this perhaps led irrevocably to a further expansion of the fissures in his flawed character, revealing he was not someone easily dissuaded from pursuing any means to personally enrich himself. By the time he arrived in Australia in 1842 aboard the schooner Wanderer, a 2-masted topsail yacht which he had purchased in 1837, Benjamin had replenished his family's wealth and was again an exceedingly prosperous man. When he finally set sail from Portsmouth in 1841, he was able to leave the family comfortably settled in care of his younger brother Mark, as he embarked on his most audacious scheme, yet this time to further enrich himself rather than his family, whose financial situation had considerably improved. Joining him and Captain Busby aboard the Wanderer was his very youngest brother, James, and Oswald Walter Brierley, the notable artist and marine painter to Queen Victoria. Other than a regular crew of 14, there was also on board 2 additional captains commissioned for his future whaling fleet. He was transporting a veritable fortune in cash and gold entrusted to him by the British government, on instructions to establish the Royal Bank of Australia with £1 million, which Benjamin had been loaned for this purpose. Intended as a luxury yacht, the 140-ton Wanderer had been armed with 6 swivel-mounted brass guns. Even though the yacht was extremely fast and could easily outrun most other ships afloat, the sea voyage to Australia took far longer than necessary and became more of a leisurely, modern-day cruise with stops in Madeira and Tenerife before sailing unexpectedly across the southern Atlantic to Rio de Janeiro, where Boyd spent 3 weeks socialising with friends and organising shooting parties for game. Then he headed south to the island of Tristan da Cunha to observe the patriarchal descendants of the original English settlers. This so fascinated Boyd, it perhaps germinated his later idea of establishing a republic in the Solomons after he absconded from Australia. From Tristan da Cunha, he continued east to the Cape of Good Hope before sailing on to Australia. The cost of his meanderings to Sydney was borne by the British government from the money and gold stored in one of the holds on his luxurious yacht. From this hoard, he also made personal business investments, including the purchase of a property on Madeira. Despite the fact his cabin boy Stevens, whom he had brought from his estate in Scotland, had his own hammock in a corner of Benjamin's cabin, this did little to discourage gossip among the crew as to why Benjamin never married. It mattered little to Benjamin what his crew thought or believed, because he understood only too well his own class would never countenance such thoughts. His crew, for the most part, could barely read or write. After all, he was a highly respected aristocrat and not some vulgar commoner. Even so, had his contemporaries known the truth, many would not have cared nor given the matter a second thought. Many of them had similar predilections. What many of his social contemporaries would have abhorred in Benjamin was his increasing inclinations towards fraud, slavery, and even murder on his arrival in Australia. J. Michael Bailey, The Wanderer, RYC, Royal Yacht Club. Chapter 1. Solomon Islands, South Pacific. His grossly obese body packed the small cabin as he continued to struggle, and his lungs heaved from the exertion. Dressed, head to foot in thick woolen clothing, he was already drenched in sweat from his efforts in the suffocating tropical heat. His labours were eventually rewarded, as he finally succeeded in returning the heavy portrait of the woman to the ornamental nail embedded in the dark teak panelling. She had finally been retrieved after more than 6 years of his incredible adventures. The portrait was of a severe and unattractive-looking woman with a large, flat nose and a prominent wart in the centre of her forehead. Miss Emma Green was the only daughter of a wealthy banker in the City of London, whose wife had died giving birth to her 24 years earlier. Eager to find her a suitor, Emma's father was hopeful that the entrepreneur would finally relieve him of the responsibility he had inherited upon the death of his wife. A rumour, encouraged by her obnoxious father, suggested that Emma was much in love with this Scottish adventurer. Benjamin Boyd had in fact originated the rumour, transmitting it subtly over time to family and friends prior to sailing from Portsmouth in December 1841 aboard the Wanderer, RYC, Royal Yacht Club. This false story was necessary for propriety in an age when men of Boyd's standing were either already married or investigating eligible candidates with pedigrees suitable to further their careers or replenish diminishing family bank accounts. The truth of the matter was that Emma Green had no interest in this immoral, self-absorbed and opinionated Scottish scoundrel already the shape of a cask of whisky. She had been forewarned that he was a rogue, intent only on restoring his family's fortunes. His father, Edward Boyd, had declared bankruptcy after speculating unsuccessfully in a transatlantic shipping venture. She had been correct in thinking him a conniving reprobate, but was wrong about his design on her fortune. He had no need of her money, for he had already been promised funding from the British government to establish the Royal Bank of Australia. Soon he would have unlimited access to upward of £1 million to finance his enterprise on the far side of the globe. His relationship with her was purely a ruse to keep society's wagging tongues from confirming what many secretly believed, but none had dared speak. He was wearing a pair of calf-length breeches and a dark purple pullover hunting shirt, the very same outfit he had worn overseeing his ship's crew as they worked the goldfields of California, a time when his desperation knew no bounds. His futile quest for gold had begun 8 months earlier. With none of the fanfare accompanying his arrival in Australia, he had quietly sailed from Sydney to escape jail for fraud and restore his finances in the American gold rush. He laced up a pair of Monticello booties over a thick pair of black socks, pulled on a Monmouth cap and knotted a kerchief around his neck. Tucked in the belt of his breeches was a brand new Colt 1847 Walker revolver he had purchased before sailing from San Francisco with the grandiose notion of setting up a white republic in the Solomon Islands. He had also packed a leather portmanteau with supplies, a little food, an extra flask of water, a compass, and two short-barreled flintlock hunting rifles he had brought with him from Merton Hall, his ancestral home in Scotland. The jolly boat rocked gently against the hull of the Wanderer, moored in a sheltered bay to the northeast of the island. Other than ripples, fanned by the breeze, the water was calm. It was coloured a light blue, fading to turquoise as it neared land. A narrow, white sandy beach with sentinels of bowed palms skirted the shore. Behind it, a near impenetrable jungle spread over most of the island that a Spanish fleet had discovered under the command of Alvaro de Mendaña in 1568. It was believed with some certainty that the island was still populated by small, isolated groups of Micronesian cannibals. After years of indulgence, hosting and attending grand society functions in Sydney, Boyd was no longer a specimen of good health. His ambitions to become the wealthiest landowner in all of Australia were financed by continually borrowing money from the very bank he had been tasked to establish by trusting investors back in London. He looked 20 years older than someone in his 50th year. The thick, greying beard he had grown did nothing to conceal the sagging jowls that accentuated a triple chin. He was a naturally large man who had an inclination to eat and drink to excess, until he seemed to be disguising more of a female form beneath men's clothing. The crew occasionally mocked him behind his back, laughing raucously over their evening portion of rum and proposing that their employer was about to deliver twins. His breathing was often laboured, and any exertion would soon raise pinprick beads of perspiration on his face. Boyd was unable to climb the rope ladder down to the dinghy below. Instead, the crew had constructed a harness solely for his use, akin to a makeshift bosun's chair. Four of the ablest crew lowered him slowly down to the dinghy, where young Stevens undid the straps supporting him from the deck above. A single rope lowered Boyd's case with the two flintlocks. He felt beneath his shirt to check that the Colt revolver was still there. Using one of the oars, Stevens shoved the jolly boat from the Wanderer, and once clear of the schooner, he began to row. The 21-year-old was strong. He pulled the oars expertly, whilst gazing at Boyd, who sat smiling at him kindly. He had only been a scrawny young lad 10 years ago when Boyd had taken him on as his cabin boy. Boyd greatly admired the transformation and the young man's bronzed physique as the dinghy drew further away from the Wanderer. J. Michael Bailey. The pair continued to shore as the crew cheered their progress. They were happy to be rid of their employer for a few hours, waving and wishing them luck on their expedition. They were off to shoot birds for dinner, hopefully sufficient in number to feed the ship's complement of 14 souls. With some assistance from Stevens, Boyd managed to rise and climb out after the small boat nudged into the soft sand. He stood up to his ankles in warm water. Stevens then dragged the craft up the beach a short way as Boyd slowly trudged towards the dense jungle through the powdery white sand. Stevens followed, carrying the portmanteau and a machete. From the Wanderer, the crew saw them as two specks disappearing from sight. They would never see either of them alive again. Boyd already understood that it would be the last time he would see the Wanderer or his crew. This was his sole reason for replacing the portrait of Lord Nelson with Emma Green, the lady whose painting would protect his reputation from that tinge of doubt. After all, had he not carried her picture always with him to remind him of a love lost long ago? Save one member of the crew, no one was aware that she had languished inside his cabin for more than 6 years. Stevens was the one who had helped him bury her beneath the bed until propriety. J. Michael Bailey was no longer necessary in a land where building fortunes was all that mattered. J. Michael Bailey, San Francisco in the 1800s. Chapter 2. San Francisco. September 1850. The population of San Francisco had swollen from around 1,000 souls in 1848 to almost 50,000 by 1850. The California goldfields were the incandescent lure for the hopes and imaginations of thousands who became enveloped as if from the silk of giant spiderwebs spun from every corner of the globe. They were amateur prospectors whose dreams of great wealth turned to despair after a few months with nothing to show for their back-breaking labour. Yet they still clung to the futile hope of striking it rich one day. There was nothing else for them to do, and the thieves, common, vagabonds, and beggars would cling like parasites to their hosts, sucking them dry before moving on to feed elsewhere. And then there were the men who, having found wealth and success, still searched for something lost, something forever beyond their reach. There were more than 100 masted ships moored at the port of San Francisco. It was not unusual for them to have to remain at anchor, out in the bay, waiting for a berth to allow people to disembark and the cargoes to be offloaded. There were men from New York and Boston, prospectors, down on their luck, looking for their next drink, pickpockets and sailors. Prostitutes did a roaring trade, whether rolling in the mud under the wharf or standing up against a whitewashed brick wall. The brothels with the expensive and cleaner girls were packed all hours of the day in a city where there were few wives to accommodate their men. San Francisco was a free-for-all, a jumbled, noisy Tower of Babel. Those from London could barely comprehend their compatriots from the colony of New South Wales, let alone the men from almost every country throughout the civilized and the not-so-civilized world. Benjamin Boyd and his brother Mark were sitting at a rough-hewn bench on three-legged stools in a raucously overcrowded room serving as a tavern, later to become the Niantic Hotel. One year earlier, it had been the interior of a whaling ship built in Connecticut in 1832. In 1849, it had brought a complement of passengers from Panama to San Francisco and was abandoned when the passengers, crew, and most of the officers headed to the goldfields to seek their fortunes. The ship was sold for desperately needed accommodation as the growing city extended beyond even the edge of the bay. Many of these water lots were later filled with sand excavated from the nearby sandhills by steam-driven excavators. Unaware of the rapid conversion of water lots to dry land, Benjamin and Mark Boyd were puzzled how this ship had become perched in the middle of a busy street some distance from the water and was now a tavern. Another ship, the Apollo, was a smaller tavern and hotel two doors down. They were drinking ale from stoneware bottles brewed by the Adam Shuppert Brewery, the first to start brewing commercially in San Francisco 1 year before. Benjamin Boyd glared at a half-intoxicated man who knocked his elbow as he was taking a swig from his bottle. Two men at one of the corner benches were arguing over a game of five stones. It would end in a fistfight, with one man being knocked out cold to lie in a heap of straw on the ground, along with three of his teeth. Mark Boyd, Benjamin's younger brother, by 3 years, had arrived 2 weeks earlier from Sydney aboard the Wanderer's tender, the Ariel. They were discussing Benjamin's options in order to extricate himself from being jailed for fraud if he returned to Australia or went back to England. The directors of the Royal Bank of Australia had built a very strong case that he had misled them since arriving in Australia to establish the bank. He had procrastinated for years over providing detailed accounts of the bank's real assets and expenditures. The extent of the fraud was only discovered when it was far too late. Boyd had been using bank funds as his personal source of financing, without any accountability to the directors and investors back home in England. It was becoming much noisier now, with some of the boisterous tavern patrons drinking to excess. They slammed their stoneware bottles hard on the tables to gain the attention of a barmaid, whose breasts almost came free from her loose white bodice. She laughed as she slapped one of the men with the back of her hand. He'd been attempting to reach up her skirt. Her slap delighted all the patrons except the Boyds, who were too engrossed in conversation to notice. The barmaid banged two more bottles on their table and then left with her arms firmly by her sides to avoid any more wandering hands searching for her husband's joy. Mark was telling Benjamin that the situation was slipping perilously out of control now that the London directors had replaced their cousin, William Sprott Boyd, as manager of the Royal Bank of Australia and had begun the process of closing it down permanently. Besides trying to apprehend Benjamin, the directors were attempting to drive Mark into bankruptcy, at which they would eventually succeed. It had been 8 years since Benjamin Boyd had first landed in Australia at Port Phillip after his circuitous pleasure cruise from Plymouth. Accompanying him aboard the Wanderer had been his brother, James, and Oswald Walters Brierley, who later became the marine artist to Queen Victoria. Others included two men who would become captains in Boyd's whaling fleet. Although Benjamin had put on significant weight since leaving Sydney, no one could ever accuse him of indolence. Mark thought. He had accomplished in 7 years what most men would not achieve in a lifetime. Benjamin was one of the most prominent landowners and graziers in the colony, with over 250,000 acres and thousands of sheep. He had owned a fleet of steamers and whaling vessels and a whaling station in Twofold Bay. He had been building his own port town with a hotel, houses, and a church. His intention had been to ship the wool from his sheep from Boydtown to Neutral Bay in Sydney to be prepared and cleaned before being shipped for England, along with tallow from his whaling industry to provide lighting for her cities and homes. He had even briefly been a leading politician after being elected to the New South Wales Legislative Council for the electoral district of Port Phillip, better known as Melbourne. Matters started to go awry for Boyd as early as 1845, 3 years after his arrival in the colony. His first setback was losing a costly legal battle involving an insurance issue resulting from damage to one of his steamers, the Seahorse. A year later, he was accused of misrepresenting accounts of the Royal Bank to the directors back in England. It resulted in his ouster in 1847, briefly in favour of his brother, Mark. His time in the colonies slowly revealed Boyd's true nature to all those closest to him. It was obvious that he was driven to succeed at all costs, with no mind to what was right or wrong. Had he built his empire on solid foundations guided by the inherent goodness in most men, his colonial adventures might never have foundered. His legacy might have been heralded and preserved for centuries. But Boyd chose a different path, as so many men do, forgetting their lives are not eternal. Striving at any cost to enrich themselves, they forget that the price is one's soul. It inevitably transpired that many of those flocking to California in the 1800s willingly traded a commodity of far more intrinsic value than any fleeting happiness wrought by material possession. The final straw for many of Benjamin Boyd's former supporters and investors was his attempt to introduce indentured servitude of South Pacific Islanders, or what was known as blackbirding in Australia at the time. The price of sheep in the colony had suddenly fallen quite sharply, and he was finding it difficult to retain labour after becoming delinquent in paying wages. His personal funds were drying up, as were the reserves at the Royal Bank of Australia. The government of New South Wales had balked at Boyd's suggestion of using convict labour, contending that it was not dissimilar to slavery, which had been abolished 15 years earlier within all the territories of the British Empire. It was too sensitive a matter to be agreed to by the Legislative Council, and so Boyd later turned to blackbirding. His captains scoured the Pacific Islands, primarily the New Hebrides, and recruited native people by enticing them with promises of great wealth if they signed contracts to work in Australia. Many were easily persuaded, unaware they were signing up to become indentured workers living in the harshest of conditions. Rarely, if ever, did they receive any compensation for their labours. After the cost of their food, accommodation and transportation had been deducted from any money they may have earned, nothing was left. Once Boyd had departed for California, these half-naked and starving island people began looking for passage back home to the islands. But with so few ships sailing in that direction, most of the islanders were abandoned, eventually to die in squalor in the back streets of Sydney. After several more ales, Benjamin and Mark finally hammered out a feasible plan that would allow Benjamin to start life anew. He had some of the money he had siphoned from the bank by way of wages he had withheld in Australia and from the sale of several properties he had acquired privately in Matthew Stevens's name. When he had first set out on his journey to the South Seas, meandering from port to port, he'd had the forethought to use some of the Royal Bank of Australia's £1 million to invest in foreign property. He'd always registered it in the name of his cabin boy, who was 10 years old at the time, with Boyd's signature and Matthew Stevens' power of attorney issued in London. Mark had been diligent in his brother's affairs and armed with Matthew's current power of J. Michael Bailey, attorney issued in Sydney, had sold everything over the past 2 years. They left the tavern and walked to the quay where Matthew was waiting with a small boat to row Mark to the Ariel and himself and Benjamin Boyd to the Wanderer, moored side by side out in San Francisco Bay. The brothers would not meet again until Guadalcanal. J. Michael Bailey, Albatross, nesting on Midway Island. Chapter 3, Uncharted Island. October 1850. On setting sail from San Francisco, the Wanderer took the direct southwesterly route for the Solomon Islands. The slower Ariel had departed almost a month earlier, sailing due west. The Ariel was a 120-ton schooner, purchased in San Francisco, that served as a tender for the Wanderer. She had on board a large stock of goods, including tomahawks, pocket knives, mirrors, paste jewellery, fancy necklets, and a number of other items worthy of bartering with the uncivilised. South Sea, island natives. It was the intention of the English sailors to exchange these trinkets for such supplies as wild pigs, fruit, cocoa, and a wide variety of other foods to sustain the crews of the two ships as they established the first settlements. It was Boyd's ambitious plan to develop a South Seas Republic of the fertile group of islands, appointing himself as president. Captain Bradley of the Ariel took a course well north of the Solomons, for he had been instructed to rendezvous with an American brigantine at a deserted atoll in the mid-Pacific. It would officially be discovered in 1856 as the Midway Atoll and claimed by the United States. In 1850, the atoll was uncharted and known only from a handful of unreported chance discoveries by ships of commerce that had anchored there to replenish water supplies and look for fresh food to supplement the usual meagre diet of hardtack biscuits, often infested with weevil maggots. The coral reef surrounding the atoll produced an abundance of marine life with over 200 species of fish and sea turtles. There were millions of wild birds, including albatrosses. Those who dismissed suspicions generated by Coleridge's poem of the Ancient Mariner soon discovered the large birds made an extremely tasty stew. Captain Bradley was under orders to investigate stories of an abundance of guano on the island. If they turned out to be correct, he was then to determine if there were sufficient quantities to mine for export to the Solomon Islands for use as agricultural fertilizer. It would take the Ariel about 8 weeks to reach Midway from San Francisco, and possibly another 7 to then sail south to the Solomons, weather conditions permitting. Allowing for the extra month, the Ariel and the Wanderer could conceivably arrive at Guadalcanal within days of each other. Mark Boyd had remained in seclusion ever since he'd secretly boarded the Ariel in San Francisco. Only Bradley and one trusted crew member, Aaron, knew that one of the owners was on board. Aaron brought Boyd food and drink and supplied him each day with soap and water. Aaron had previously been in the employ of the Boyd estate in Scotland and was considered almost family. Mark Boyd had his own private toilet in his cabin with a view down it to the ocean below. He had passed the hours poring over reams of barely decipherable notes and columns of meaningless figures in his brother's hand in an attempt to understand where all the money had gone. The more he tried to untangle the weave of Benjamin's financial history from the time he had set forth from Portsmouth 10 years before, the more he realized that his brother would most certainly be committed for trial for fraud. It was impossible to calculate exactly how much of the money he had used for his personal financial ventures, but it was significant. As much as £200,000 of expenditures by way of personal bank loans to himself as managing director of the Royal Bank of Australia had not been reported to the bank's directors back in London. Among other things, Benjamin had used the money to develop Boyd Town, becoming the largest ship owner in Australia in the process. He also became the largest landowner and grazier in New South Wales, with over 200,000 head of sheep. All this had been accomplished in the first 4 years after his arrival in the colony. Mark knew with absolute certainty that his brother could never have achieved any of it without the bank as his well of fortune. No one would ever know that Benjamin had purchased several properties on his meandering voyage to Australia, spending over £60,000. The handsome profit he made after selling these properties, the equivalent of £10,000 he had deposited, along with the principal, at an extremely favourable rate in the Massachusetts Bank in Boston, the second oldest in the country. Its original charter had been signed by none other than John Hancock, and Mark knew the money would be safe there and readily accessible when required. Mark was woken early in the morning by the rattle of the anchor chain. He knew they were in shallow water because the anchor took no time at all to settle on the ocean bed. It was soon holding the schooner in position, yet not quite motionless as the ship creaked, slowly turning with the drift of the currents. He peeked through the small porthole that had been his only window to the outside world for the past 2 months, other than the view from the head to the sea below when he was urinating. The sun was just rising, casting an orange glow across two or three small islands. They appeared to be quite flat, with just a handful of tropical palms scattered randomly in a lunarscape of low-growing vegetation. Almost immediately, deafening trills overloaded his sense of hearing until he had to place his hands over his ears. Even this did not block out the cacophony of noise made by millions of birds nesting on land or circling above the sheltered islands protected in the coral shallows. Then he began to see the shape of a coral reef as small waves outlined it like a pearl necklace, strung around a slender turquoise neck. He had seen albatrosses now and then at sea, including a pair that perched in the upper riggings of a ship, resting in mid-ocean until their massive wings would carry them on the remainder of their flight. But never before had he witnessed, nor indeed had he ever imagined, the sheer numbers of birds gathered in such a small area. There must have been over 2 million albatrosses, either swirling effortlessly above the island and the aerial, or protecting a million nests on shore. 3 million birds of different species added to the tumultuous cascade of bird calls emanating from every direction of the compass. Mark was unaware that many of the larger birds were already roosting in the ship's rigging, cursed by the crew splattered by their droppings. Captain Bradley had no real need to go ashore to know there would be sufficient guano to export to the Solomons, if not to England itself. He could see the two-masted American brigantine with sails furled on the other side of the atoll. There were no flags flying to indicate her nationality, and the crew of the mystery ship had draped part of an old sail over the stern to ensure that no one on the British ship would ever know its name. Only Captain Bradley and Mark Boyd knew it was the Pacific Pearl. The crew above deck was too busy avoiding the bird droppings to give much attention to the larger ship at anchor. One sailor on the aerial warned it could be pirates who still roamed the oceans in the 1850s, but the idea was quickly dismissed and the presence of the ship forgotten. Leaving Aaron on watch late that night as the rest of the crew slept, Mark Boyd and Captain Bradley descended quietly down the Jacob's Ladder to the wooden dinghy that Bradley had ordered lowered from its davits shortly after they had arrived at the atoll. The dinghy was spattered with bird droppings, but the J. Michael Bailey Birds Chorus was silent for the night. Some roosted on their nests, asleep with one eye open, alert for any indication of danger. Millions of other birds roosted on the ground or in the shallows, protected by the reef. Earlier that evening, Aaron had loaded the dinghy with two saddlebags, one containing some of Benjamin Boyd's accounts and the other $500 in cash. It took them a little over an hour to row over to the Pacific Pearl on the outer edge of the reef. It was just after 1 a.m. when the dinghy finally nudged alongside the brigantine. "Captain Bradley," an American with a southern drawl called out above, "careful climbing up. Don't want to lose either of you." J. Michael Bailey, Guadalcanal, Solomon Islands, 1800s. Chapter 4. Guadalcanal, South Pacific. October 29th, 1851. Using his machete, Stevens began slashing a passage through the tangled undergrowth of the rainforest, thriving alongside the beaches, the full length of the coast. Like a quilt blanket of numerous shades of green, it covered almost the entire island, stretching some 30 miles to the south and more than 90 miles from east to west. In the centre of the island, this living cover, teeming with over 30 million species of plants and animals, climbed a rugged mountain range dominated by a peak almost 8,000 feet high. Beyond, raging torrents caused by the tropical rainfall on that side of the island had cut deep valleys to the southern shore. The rushing waters carrying silt from the mountains eventually collided with the pounding waves along the south coast to create beaches of black sand. Their sharp blades would have no effect at all if they attempted to penetrate deeper into the jungle further south. The tangled forest there was too dense to cut through. Only 10 minutes after leaving the beach, Stevens was already drenched in sweat. He had taken off his shirt and his skin glistened from the rays of sunlight that would periodically lance through the canopy of trees above. Benjamin Boyd was labouring his way behind, also sweating profusely and gasping for each breath from the effort of carrying the leather portmanteau with the two short-barrel rifles inside. He had already discarded his woolen cap and was now considering taking off his thick woolen purple shirt. He had always been embarrassed, displaying his corpulent body in front of Stevens, and had never done so in daylight. Now he could only prolong the inevitable until necessity would finally overcome his reluctance. Several more minutes passed before the humidity and the heat forced him to strip bare from the waist up, exposing a porcelain white torso that justified the crew's cruel comments comparing him to a pregnant woman carrying twins. He slung his water flask back across his shoulder and continued trudging on. Boyd was beginning to worry that they had not brought sufficient water for their journey. It didn't concern him whether they had enough food, because there was evidence in abundance that the region was teeming with life. He'd heard hundreds of strange bird calls, and the staccato screeches from tropical animals in the verdant canopy above were like exotic melodies. Two megapodes, as big as small turkeys, startled them, suddenly crashing through the undergrowth, before being swallowed again just as quickly. Stevens noticed a large, poisonous centipede as they continued on their way and crushed it with his boot. The Wanderer had moored in a sheltered, crescent-shaped bay to the northwest of the island. The beach formed a white, sandy edge following the bay until it disappeared around the two short headlands. Benjamin and Mark Boyd had managed to acquire a copy of the only Admiralty chart of the island available in San Francisco. They had determined that there was a similar bay roughly 10 miles further along the coast. This is where Benjamin Boyd and Stevens were now headed. To enable them to cut across the headland, they would first have to hack a way through the dense undergrowth a few yards inland from the beach. Once they reached the other side, they would no longer be in view from the Wanderer, allowing them the possibility of walking the remainder of the journey along the shore. 2 hours later, they were well out of sight of the Wanderer, now far out in the bay on the other side of the headland. Stevens wanted to forge a path directly towards the beach, but Boyd needed to stop a while, he said, to recover from the exertion of the morning. He sat down on a fallen tree in a small clearing and took some food from the portmanteau without offering any to Stevens. To conserve their water supply, they drank sparingly from the flasks, each carried hung by leather straps across their shoulders. Stevens inquired whether Boyd was up to continuing the remainder of the journey, another 7 miles or so, or whether he wanted to camp on the beach for the night. Boyd said he would be fine after a few more minutes of rest. The next stage of the plan, Benjamin Boyd purposely failed to discuss with his brother. Mark would never have countenanced the idea. Benjamin was a little surprised at his own feeling of reluctance at first, perhaps because he had grown rather fond of Stevens these past 10 years since they first set sail on their meandering adventure to Australia, which had ended in such abysmal failure. It had been only after reaching Sydney at the age of 11 that Stevens began sharing the owner's cabin whenever the Wanderer put to sea. Stevens was an orphan, and Benjamin Boyd was the only person ever to demonstrate any form of kindness towards him. The man had been his only family. They began their trek again once Boyd was fully rested. Stevens continued as before, chopping at the smaller branches heading in the direction of the ocean, with glimpses of the turquoise water now visible just ahead. Boyd was not far behind. On the Wanderer, they heard the explosion of a gun on shore. It disturbed hundreds of colourful parrots that flew from their perches. All on board cheered, already salivating at the thought of the fresh fowl they would be roasting on the beach later that evening. They had already been promised an extra portion of rum by the chief mate. One of the petty officers had bought a contraption called a concertina in San Francisco and had become quite adept, playing various sea shanties and broadside ballads. Excited about what lay in store, the crew went about their duties with an exuberance they had not displayed since leaving San Francisco weeks before. Benjamin Boyd shot Stevens in the back of his head at close range with his Colt pistol. He had not hesitated, nor did he ever experience any sense of remorse from that day forth. Stevens crashed heavily to the ground, already dead. Blood briefly pooled from his head wound before running slowly in red rivulets seeping through the sand. Over the next 5 minutes or so, Boyd fired several more shots from the Colt into the air. Then he fired both of the flintlocks in the same direction. He picked up the machete, rolled Stevens over with one of his Monticello booties, and began slashing the young man's face and upper body with the machete before finally plunging it deep into his chest. He took the portmanteau and scattered the contents and discarded the bag. Then he took off his booties and black socks and smeared them with blood from Stevens' body and threw them back along the track. After soaking his purple shirt in blood, he threw it over an epiphyte growing on the side of a tall tree. Before filling his water bottle from Stevens's, he took off his own trouser belt and dropped it on the ground close to the former cabin boy. Then he placed the Colt beneath his body. Picking up the other two discharged guns, he carried them towards the ocean. His feet sank into sand so soft as to leave no footprints as he walked, half naked and splattered with blood, to the shore and then paddled through the shallow water along the beach. It was close to 2 hours later when he first caught sight of the Pacific Pearl and began waving his arms. He threw the two hunting rifles out over the turquoise shallows into the darker blue ocean where they would never be found. They had built a small bonfire on the beach shortly before dusk. 12 of the crew stood in a semicircle as the second mate walked along pouring the golden elixir into the tin cups each man was holding. The other two, including the first mate, remained aboard the Wanderer on watch. They had already been given their portions of rum and so were quite content to remain behind. Having inched along the bowsprit, they sat with their tin cups, watching the fire grow brighter as the night approached. The fire eventually started to subside and it became too dark to gather more wood. There was no moon. The jungle shadows were encroaching and the men wanted to return to the ship before the fire went out completely. Most of the crew on shore were deeply superstitious. Some had already begun suggesting their employer and Stevens were dead and boiling in some cannibal's pot, or had perhaps been devoured by some unknown slimy creature crawling along the floor of the rainforest. Too much strong rum also drove their fears. And as the flickers from the dying fire cast dancing shadows on the aerial mangrove roots, they illuminated what seemed a terrifying army of small creatures heading slowly towards them. The crew returned to the Wanderer without Boyd and Stevens. The next morning they woke to see a small group of natives on shore throwing stones and hurling what looked like spears in the Wanderer's direction. It was obviously a futile exercise as the ship was moored a good distance from the shore. The first mate decided to take 3 men ashore in one of the jolly boats to investigate. He would not have endangered himself and the crew if the Boyd and Stevens had not gone missing. Questions would be asked and reports written to establish what had happened once they arrived back in England. He would have to demonstrate he had done all that was expected of him. As soon as the boat neared shore, the natives, wearing only small loincloths, began wading towards the boat. The first mate ordered one of the men to fire a warning shot, but they kept on wading closer, continuing to hurl stones and shouting curses in a language none of the Englishmen understood. The first mate then took his own pistol from his belt and fired a shot just over the head of the leader of the angry group. He continued ploughing through the water towards them until a second shot hit him in the chest. The others immediately turned in the water and fled, leaving their chief face down and staining the turquoise water crimson red. Once ashore, the 4 sailors stopped a while when they reached the edge of the beach and the rainforest. The first mate had decided they must find Boyd and Stevens. It was looking more likely that they had come to harm. They soon found the track Stevens had carved from the jungle and began following it, alert now to every rustle or sound of breaking twigs. It took them an hour before they finally came upon Stephen's body. Already, in less than 12 hours, the corpse was covered in maggots and carrion flies. Something else, a larger animal, or several king rats, had been tearing chunks of flesh from his chest. One of the sailors vomited, and another suggested they leave immediately and head back to the ship before becoming carrion for the rats themselves. Before they left, they collected Stevens and Boyd's few belongings and placed them inside the empty portmanteau. They found the Colt beneath Stevens' body, but no sign of the other guns they knew a Boyd had taken with him to shoot birds. One of them remembered that at least one of the gunshots they had heard from the Wanderer was from a flintlock, a quite different sound from the Colt. It seemed apparent that the natives had attacked them, and Stevens had been using the Colt to fend them off. Boyd's body was never discovered, and it was assumed the natives had carried him away as a trophy, perhaps to boil. J. Michael Bailey. And eat later. They buried Stevens in a shallow grave in the sand, using their bare hands to dig. The four crew then retreated to the safety of the ship as expeditiously as they could, in case the remaining natives, infuriated by the death of their chief, swam out to the Wanderer and attempted to board her. J. Michael Bailey, Benjamin Boyd returning from the Solomons. Chapter 5. Solomons to San Francisco. December 1851. Captain Bradley of the Ariel and many of the crew knew Mark Boyd by sight, yet only Bradley was privy to certain aspects of their secret voyage to the South Seas. From the outset, he was purposely led to believe the need for secrecy was a condition of the British Admiralty, which had a non-commercial interest in the voyage. This was what Mark Boyd had told Bradley months before in San Francisco. No one, apart from the two brothers, had any idea the real purpose was to assist Benjamin to disappear forever. Certainly, Captain Edward Blythe of the Pacific Pearl had no advance knowledge, and Captain Bradley was told only that Mark Boyd was sailing secretly to Midway to confirm there were substantial commercial quantities of guano on the island to be harvested. Prior to leaving San Francisco, Bradley had met privately with the captain of the Pacific Pearl and had paid him a hefty advance to take Mark Boyd from Midway to the Solomon Islands. He promised that the remainder would be payable on their return to San Francisco. The city on the bay the British had seriously considered annexing from Mexico only a decade earlier. Bradley had introduced Mark Boyd to Captain Blith as Aiken Taverner, an agricultural specialist under instruction from the Admiralty. As far as anyone was aware, apart from Bradley, his purview to export guano from Midway to the Solomon Islands was intended as an initial study into the feasibility of future intensive farming projects in other developing countries of the empire. More importantly, he was told, the Admiralty also had an interest in guano because of its high explosive content. Once Bradley and the Ariel were well over the horizon and on their way to Cape Town, Aiken Taverner, or Mark Boyd, instructed the captain of the Pacific Pearl to set a different course for the return voyage from Midway to San Francisco. They would go via the Solomon Islands, adding over 5,000 nautical miles to the voyage to collect two English botanists who had been exploring the islands. The captain saw the bag of gold coins Aiken was prepared to pay for the inconvenience and immediately agreed, asking no questions. The captain was also aware that Aiken would be handing him a sight draft for the original balance due once they arrived back in San Francisco. They anchored 5 days later in a separate bay from the Wanderer, a few miles further up the coast, and settled down to wait. The crew were happy to have the time off. They relaxed in hammocks above decks in the warm sunshine with plenty of grog. They were not allowed ashore in case contact was established inadvertently with crew from the Wanderer, or there was a chance encounter with the natives who were considered dangerous. Expeditions ashore for food or water were also not permitted. The Pacific Pearl already had plenty of fresh water aboard to drink, but it was rationed for personal hygiene, limited to one bucket each twice a week. Those who could swim jumped from the deck to refresh themselves in the cool, clear water below. But after a week, Mark Boyd was beginning to become concerned. His brother and Stevens should have shown up 3 days ago. Like many of the others, he was starting to believe the botanists were already dead, and he was almost convinced of it when they heard gunshots a few miles up the coast. Mark suggested sending a search party ashore, but the idea was quickly dismissed by the captain, who was reluctant to risk the lives of his men. He told Mark Boyd they would wait one more day before setting sail. In all likelihood, the botanists were dead, boiled, and digested by this time. Several hours later, one of the sailors on the ship suddenly saw someone in the distance stumbling through the water close to shore. Benjamin Boyd sat waiting in the shade under a slender, bowed palm that seemed to be genuflecting towards the brigantine moored offshore. He could just make out two men clambering into the small boat, knocking gently against the hull of the Pacific Pearl. He had no doubt that one was his brother. There were a dozen or so other men on deck, all staring out over the turquoise blue in his direction. The small craft finally came ashore, and he saw his brother get out and walk towards him over the sand. The sailor who'd rowed them both remained with the boat. Even from that distance, Mark could tell there was something seriously wrong. Benjamin was half naked, and he had what looked like blood covering his face and torso. He had been burnt raw from the sun. "Heaven help us, what transpired for you to arrive in this condition, dear brother?" Mark took off his jacket and draped it over Benjamin's shoulders to protect him from the hot sun. "Where is Stevens?" he asked. Benjamin had to dissuade his brother from organizing a search party to recover Stevens' remains. He told him how his former cabin boy had been butchered by at least 6 or 7 Micronesians, most likely cannibals, but that was not before he had put up tremendous resistance, permitting Benjamin to escape. As he ran for the beach towards the ocean, Benjamin told Mark he had turned briefly to see Stevens fall. The natives began slashing at his body with their machetes. "Luckily, they did not come after him," he said. Stevens' misfortune allowed Benjamin time to wade out into the sea, splashing through the shallow water in a frantic escape. "The crew from the Wanderer will no doubt find his remains at first light on the morrow, brother, once they realize we are missing after dark. God willing, they will provide him with a decent burial and read passages from the Holy Scriptures over him. He was well loved by us all." Benjamin paused and whispered, "And may the good Lord bring him eternal peace." "Amen," said Mark. It took the brigantine over 5 weeks to return to San Francisco from Guadalcanal. During the long voyage, Benjamin remained in his cabin, alone until nightfall, or occasionally Mark would come to see him during the day to speak on various matters. They had agreed that Benjamin should remain out of sight for the duration of the voyage, allowing him time to recover from his severe sunburn, but primarily to avoid any possibility of recognition. Only late at night would he venture from his cabin to stretch his legs when there was little chance of him being noticed. All the crew had seen of the botanist was when they had helped him aboard with the assistance of Mark. The coat covering his shoulders partly obscured his face when he stepped onto the deck of the Pacific Pearl. Not that it would have mattered had anyone seen his face, because by the time the ship docked out in San Francisco Bay, no one would have recognized him. Mark had cropped his brother's hair short, and over several weeks Benjamin washed it in a strong soap called lye, made from ashes and goat fat. His hair became much lighter and tinged with red, a process discovered in olden times when the J. Michael Bailey Vikings purposely made themselves look fiercer with their long, flowing red hair and beards. Benjamin had also shaved off his mutton chops and had started wearing a corset to enable him to dress in a fashionable suit appropriate for his profession. A Chinese tailor in San Francisco had made it for him months before he had departed for the South Seas on the Wanderer. Mark had brought it with him on the Ariel, along with some shirts and other accessories for his brother to wear. Benjamin, at long last, was starting to relax. He slept soundly each night on the voyage over to California. Never once had he thought about Stevens since departing Guadalcanal. The Pacific Pearl found a mooring in San Francisco Bay on March 2, 1852. It was cold and blustery out on the water as they were rowed to shore. Rain clouds scurried low overhead and sea spray from the gusting wind drenched them both. For the first time, Benjamin thought back to Guadalcanal and the devoted cabin boy who had taken care of him for over 10 years. But he soon erased the errant thought from his mind and wiped away only the rain from his face with the back of his sleeve. California would not be admitted to the Union until 3 years later, in 1855, and it remained quite isolated from the rest of the country for over a decade after that. The railroads had not yet been built, and Benjamin Boyd's destination precluded him from reaching it by boat. Travelling overland by horse was his only choice, which would take him several weeks. Not only was the journey over rugged terrain, it was dangerous. Encounters with the Comanches remained a threat, despite the treaty the tribe had signed, assuring the safety of white settlers. There were other hostile tribes looking to scalp the white man as well, angry with the US government for so many broken treaties. Outlaws and every other charlatan, quack and vagabond, also roamed the West. They would be merciless if they happened on such easy prey as the Boyds, especially if the brothers had attempted their journey alone. Mark and Benjamin had ridden as far as Los Angeles with two trusted scouts they had contracted in San Francisco, one a Pawnee from Oregon, and the other a French scout who had drifted down from Canada and tried unsuccessfully to pan for gold. The four then picked up the old Spanish trail to Santa Fe in New Mexico, which had been maintained as a U.S. provisional territory since being ceded to the U.S. by Mexico with the end of the U.S.-Mexican War 3 years before. Other than a mummified body they found hanging from a tree, possibly a rustler, they cut it down and quickly buried it. Their journey to Santa Fe was unremarkable. They arrived at their destination safely, but longing for soft beds and warm baths. J. Michael Bailey. The brothers then parted company in Santa Fe. Benjamin continued riding southeast with the French scout, while Mark headed north with the Pawnee to New York. From there, Mark hoped to find quick passage home to Liverpool. J. Michael Bailey. Chapter 6. Marshall, Texas, May 1852. Benjamin Boyd and his half-breed Canadian scout, Leon, rode alongside one another down the dusty main street of Marshall in Harrison County, Texas. Like half-empty sacks of grain, they sagged in their saddles from exhaustion. Both horses and men were desperately tired and hungry, with tongues of leather parched from thirst. They were also in need of a hot bath after their arduous and often perilous journey from Santa Fe, where they had parted company with Mark Boyd and his Pawnee scout almost 4 weeks before. Marshall had been founded in 1841, the same year Boyd had sailed from Portsmouth to Australia. 11 years later, it was the fourth largest city in Texas, with a bustling population of around 1,700. They left the horses at a livery stable next to the barber shop and then trudged back in the scorching heat to the Marshall Hotel, smacking the dust haphazardly from their clothes along the way. They took two rooms for a week at a cost of $7 a day plus 50 cents each for use of a tin plunge bath. They had a meal of meat and potatoes swilled down with persimmon beer and shots of bourbon whiskey down in the saloon. Refreshed, yet slightly intoxicated, they stumbled up to the mezzanine level overlooking the saloon, each to a separate small room with views of the main street, baking in the heat. Across the street, Benjamin Boyd could see a row of newly constructed wooden coffins standing upright outside a carpenter's shop, waiting for customers, dead or alive. Hardly mattered. A mangy dog slunk past, lifted its leg, and urinated inside one of the coffins. His room was slightly larger than Leon's, and the walls were so thin it was impossible not to hear the Daughters of Sin hard at work, three rooms down. Boyd sat on the side of his bed and admired a young Negro slave who brought up several buckets of hot water from the wood stove down in the kitchen to fill the old tin tub. He smiled at the young boy, who kept his eyes to the ground. Boyd took off his boots and clothes and lowered himself into the warm water. He luxuriated there for a good hour, the accumulation of a month's worth of dirt seeping from his pores until he started to feel clean again. When he was finished, he dried himself off with a small towel, threw his clothes to soak in the bath, and collapsed naked on the bed. He slept for 10 hours straight, oblivious to the fights and commotions and gunshots beneath his window during the night. It was Mark who had suggested he go to Marshall when they had met in San Francisco before Benjamin set sail for Guadalcanal almost 1 year earlier. Marshall was in the northeast of the state, over 200 miles from Galveston. The land in Harrison County was suitable for growing almost anything. Cotton was a burgeoning crop, brought by farmers from Louisiana. Land was only 35 cents an acre, and folk in the state still minded their own business. seldom asking questions about their neighbors. The Caddo Indians of East Texas were largely peaceful people who had been there to welcome the Spanish. Once the Anglos began arriving in numbers, the Caddo people were slowly pushed from their land to live on reservations. Feeling refreshed after a good night's sleep in his first real bed since leaving San Francisco, Boyd ordered a cup of thick black coffee at the bar. None of the crew of the Wanderer would have recognized him had they been standing next to him. He was clean-shaven, and his hair had grown in curls, shaded a light ginger brown. Most notable was all the weight he had lost since the day he was hoisted down from the Wanderer to young Stevens waiting in the jolly boat to row him ashore. He appeared years younger and was no longer stooped like an aging man carrying a pregnant belly before him, which his crew had found so titillating. They would all have agreed that the twins had been delivered months before. There was a newspaper on the floor, and he bent and picked it up. It was a copy of the Texas Republican dated March 13, 1852, not quite 2 months old. On the back page, there was a for sale notice for a farm comprising 1,000 acres, with a plain but substantial dwelling, including a blacksmith shop and a gin house. There was an apple and peach orchard. The primary crop was oats, but over 200 acres were used for cotton. The property came with 9 good Negroes in number, all good hands, and 5 of them, very likely. An E. Fraser had signed the advertisement. Leon the Scout had been checking on the horses over at the livery. He returned to the saloon to order a breakfast of cornbread, stew, and boiled eggs, along with a pot of the same thick coffee. The plan was for them to ride south to Galveston in about a week to visit the Galveston Banco de Comercio y Agricultura, originally established by the previous Mexican administration. There they would draw an amount of silver and gold coinage on presentation of 3 promissory notes, each of $1,000, in the name of Samuel Bethel. The notes were issued by the oldest colonial bank in Massachusetts, founded in the 17th century. Most of the money would go on deposit at the same bank, immediately establishing Samuel Bethel as one of its wealthiest clients. 2 years earlier, Mark Boyd had prepared this monetary transaction when the two brothers had hatched a plan for Benjamin to disappear. He'd given the notes to Benjamin in San Francisco when they returned from Guadalcanal. The money could be drawn only from this one chartered bank in Texas. Mark had also handed Benjamin a copy, witnessed by a Presbyterian minister, of the birth records of a deceased parishioner by the name of Samuel Bethel, who had been born in a small village 10 miles from Aberdeen in 1801. He would have been a year older than Benjamin, and had once worked on his father's estate at Merton Hall. This certified birth entry from the parish register would suffice as sufficient proof of Benjamin's new identity in an age long before passports or national birth certificates. Boyd's Canadian scout had agreed to ride with him to Galveston and accompany him on his return journey when he would be carrying sufficient funds to buy the 1,000 acres advertised by E. Fraser in the Texas Republican newspaper. Leon also agreed to stay on at the plantation for several months once the purchase was complete to help settle the property. By then, title to the property would be legally in the name of Samuel Bethel. It was the name by which the scout had known Boyd since they had first met in San Francisco. J. Michael Bailey, Benjamin Boyd in Middle Age, Chapter 7. Benjamin Yule, 1864. Within Harrison County and most of northeastern Texas, he had always been known as Benjamin Yule, a name borrowed from his maternal grandfather in Scotland. The only people in the country who knew him by any other name worked at the banks in Galveston and in Boston, where he was known as Samuel Bethel. He had considered waiting until the cotton was harvested in late July before leaving after the new owner had taken over the plantation. He had become increasingly anxious, though, as the Union forces once again regained control of Galveston. He could buy passage on a blockade runner carrying cotton to the Bahamas or Cuba, where goods were transferred to other ships bound for England or elsewhere in Europe. But that would be risky. he decided it would be better to find one sailing from Matamoros, the sister city to Brownsville, across the Rio Grande in Mexico. So, placing caution before profit, he left the cotton to root rot in the fields and departed sooner. He had accumulated sufficient money since arriving in Marshall 11 years ago. He had tripled the size of that poorly managed plantation, and his revenues had increased tenfold. He had also increased the mere handful of slaves he owned in 1852 to 83, counting the Picaninny. Why take the risk? The inevitable Union victory would bring an end to it all soon enough. It was high time to leave and plunge into a new life, living somewhere close to the sea and far from the shadows of his past and from English-speaking societies. He craved variety in his food, especially fish, or anything other than the massive beefsteaks that had been his primary diet for the past decade. A good claret would not go amiss either. Most of all, he yearned again for someone young to attend to his needs and keep him company in his old age. Anton, the young Negro boy, had become far too sullen as he'd grown older. Benjamin was concerned that his companion would cut his throat one night, once the slaves were freed and perhaps running rampant after the war. God forbid, he often complained to himself, they might actually want to be paid to work as well. On the night he had chosen to leave, he dressed in a full-length duster coat and black leather Stetson, summoned Anton to his room, and the moment he walked in, smashed him in the back of the neck with the shoulder stock of his rifle. By the light of a small kerosene lamp by the bed, which was projecting shadows dancing along the walls in an eerie yellow glow, he heaved his victim onto the bed and placed him in a sleeping position on top of the blanket. He took off the man's boots but left on his worn socks. For good measure, just to ensure his victim remained unconscious, Benjamin hit him once more, this time quite brutally, in the side of the head, yet without killing him. He then picked up a can of kerosene and began splashing the contents over the bed and the unconscious man, around the bedroom walls and onto the floor. After dropping the can, he took the kerosene lamp from the table and walked towards the door. From there, he threw the lamp back at the table where it shattered on the floor, immediately sending a line of flame tracking towards the bed and up the walls. Before the room was fully engulfed, he locked the door behind him and hurried from the house, which was now fully illuminated from the shafts of light of a full moon slicing the darkness inside through the windows. He quickly mounted the horse, tethered to a small tree outside. Taking one last look behind him, he noticed the first licks of flame at the back of the house and smoke belching from the front door. He lashed the horse, urging it into a full gallop, heading from the cotton plantation south towards Brownsville. He knew it would not be long before the alarm was raised and the other slaves were rushing from their beds in terror. They would frantically search for anything that would hold water in futile attempts to extinguish the flames. After 10 years working a cotton plantation, Benjamin Boyd no longer remotely resembled the corpulent owner of the schooner Wanderer who had disembarked for that last time on Guadalcanal. He was now lean and muscular from his years of management in the fields, always acutely aware that leading by example was the only way to increase the productivity of his slaves. His hair flowed in golden curly locks, and his sagging jowls had vanished, giving him the distinctive appearance of a man much younger than 63. His brother Mark could have passed him on Regent Street and would not have given him a second glance. Benjamin even seemed taller, no longer stooped, as he used to be from carrying so much extra weight. Had he ever felt the desire, and were a man still in his 40s, he could have had any young woman he wanted. It took him 13 days of hard riding to reach Brownsville and the Rio Grande. Early the next morning, after a good night's sleep in a soft bed, he used the recently reopened crossing into Matamoros, or the Port of Baghdad, as it was also known. By 1880, the town was officially non-existent. At the end of the 19th century, it was invisible, completely covered over by the shifting sand. In 1864, however, Matamoros was a bustling port where ships of all nations, except those flying the US Union flag, disgorged their cargoes of armaments from England, Germany, and France to resupply the besieged Confederacy just across the river before loading bales of cotton for export to Europe and beyond. The blockade of Union ships was powerless to stop them, without creating an international incident that might have led one, if not all of the world's superpowers of the day, to declare war. This was something the Union could ill afford when it was already embroiled in a civil war, the outcome of which was yet to be determined. Boyd found an inexpensive hotel down by the quay and rented a room, initially for 3 nights, trusting in the meantime that he would find passage on a foreign vessel sailing to Cuba. The island served as the nearest transshipment hub for the Confederacy for all European imports and exports. 8 days later, he booked passage on the Jane Cockerell, a British merchant ship bound for Liverpool via Havana, loaded with 400 bales of cotton. He sold his horse for $250 and spent his last day studying maps of Cuba he had found in a small shop across the road from his hotel. On May 28, 1864, the Jane Cockerell set sail with the passenger Samuel Bethel aboard, bound for Cuba and the Caribbean. Texas Republican, Tuesday, May 3, 1864. A plantation home southwest of the city was discovered burnt to the ground after one of its slaves raised the alarm to a passing citizen on horseback. On investigation, the police authorities in Marshall determined the house had been torched by one of the slaves called Anton. There was a strong smell of kerosene detected in an area where one of the bedrooms had been located. There were also the remains of a human being. Police presume the dead person was no other than Benjamin Yule, a prominent local citizen. The police are treating Mr. Yule's death as an apparent murder and wish to question the slave, Anton, who has vanished and is nowhere to be found. An Indian scout tracked a horse the slave must have stolen for 20 miles until the tracks disappeared after an apparent rainfall in the area. All efforts are being made to apprehend the Negro for this terrible crime to face justice, which we hope he will receive shortly by dangling from the end of a rope. J. Michael Bailey, Baracoa, Cuba. Chapter 8. Baracoa, Cuba, 1883. Benjamin Boyd lived until he was 82, another 19 years, in a small town called Baracoa, located in a remote part of eastern Cuba. It had an insouciant feel and was set in stunningly beautiful natural surrounds. Verdant mountains and rivers encompassed a sweeping bay with beaches of white sand brushed by the turquoise waters of the Caribbean. The years in Baracoa were amongst the happiest of his entire life. In such a place he found the freedom he had always craved. The local inhabitants made no judgment of others and had no interest in who they shared their beds with. It was a town where social conventions were an anathema, since these conflicted with the lives they all wanted to lead in freedom. It was the reason most had sought it out in the first place, somewhere so remote they could live in peace, where the state had little or no influence. Benjamin Boyd died in 1883. During his Cuban years, he had never thought of Stevens, whom he had murdered in Guadalcanal, nor the young Negro boy he had burnt alive on his plantation near the town of Marshall in Texas. He had never dwelled on the past, only the future and himself. He had no regrets, and he died peacefully in his sleep. His funeral was attended by many of the townsfolk, who followed his coffin, carried by 4 young men from his house, by the beach, to a cemetery on a hill nearby with a spectacular view of the ocean. Mark Boyd had died 5 years earlier at the Alexandra Hotel in Hyde Park in London, aged 74. He had never heard from his brother again. J. Michael Bailey, Merton Hall, Newton Stewart, Wigtownshire, Scotland, Benjamin Boyd's ancestral home. Author note: Benjamin Boyd's achievements and failures in Australia are well documented. In a relatively short space of time, about 6 years, he accumulated an astonishing amount of wealth to become one of the richest men in the country. He owned thousands of acres of land and property and was known to be the largest grazier in New South Wales, with almost 200,000 head of sheep, the wool from which he transported to sell in London on his expanding fleet of ships. South of Sydney, he purchased swathes of land in the vicinity of Eden, where he began developing his own town. called Boydtown, that included a hotel, houses for his workers, and a church with its own cemetery, which still stands today behind the original hotel carrying the name of one of his ships in the fleet he had brought with him from England, the Seahorse. As a result of one of his questionable business schemes for a brief while, he quite literally owned the entire colony of New Zealand. Benjamin is also credited, along with others, for establishing a profitable whaling industry, along with the assistance of the killer whales, the orcas, that herded the humpback from their migratory routes along the eastern shore of New South Wales. Finally, corralling them in the confines of Twofold Bay, the whalers worked together with the orcas to slaughter the humpback for a number of valuable resources, including meat, oil, and baleen, then finally boiled for their blubber to make candles providing light to the streets and homes of England. The tongues of the humpbacks were later fed as treats to the orcas. Had Benjamin Boyd pursued his various business activities in an honourable fashion, as the majority of his contemporaries governed themselves, he undoubtedly would be remembered today as one of the first great Australians to help establish the new country. Instead, he chose to squander his legacy with a mindset of enriching solely himself and his family to some lesser degree. The cash and gold he had brought from England to establish the Royal Bank of Australia proved far too much of a tempting lure. Free from any oversight, he was able to use much of the bank's money interest-free as investments for his own projects. The Royal Australian Bank had a board of directors back in Scotland, but Boyd continually ignored their requests for comprehensive annual financial reports or, indeed, any form of accountability. And even without the fraud, Boyd is also remembered as a blackbirder, someone who circumvented the law against slavery that had been abolished throughout the empire in 1833. He would sail to the Pacific Islands to persuade islanders to work in Australia without any intention of ever paying them as he originally promised. Barely clothed and poorly fed, they worked long hours with no recourse to even return to their islands. Those who ran away often ended up on the streets of Sydney, intending to find passage home when few ships ever sailed in the direction, often eventually starving or freezing to death. Those who remained in slavery were appallingly mistreated by beatings or often thrown from Boyd's ships into the frigid waters of Twofold Bay to drown when they refused to load them with goods intended for England. Benjamin Boyd left Australia on October 26, 1849. Sailing from Port Jackson, Sydney, for the Californian goldfields aboard. J. Michael Bailey, his yacht, the Wanderer, following the collapse of his financial empire in the colony, he departed with many plans to seek new opportunities before eventually vanishing in the Solomon Islands in 1851. He is reputed to have been killed by cannibals, but this was never substantiated. Even the Admiralty was wary of such assertions, and several ships were commissioned over the next few years in attempts to locate Benjamin Boyd. Barely 50 years earlier, much had been written about the fate of Fletcher Christian, the mutineer from the HMS Bounty. Before it was established, he had actually died in an uprising on Pitcairn Island. There had been multiple rumours, and even one credible account he had escaped back to England and was living on a small island in Windermere. The difference between the Bounty and the Wanderer accounts is that undeniable proof was later presented as to what happened to Fletcher Christian. To this very day, no one knows what really happened to Benjamin Boyd. My account is just one of numerous possibilities of the last years of the mysterious and ruthless Benjamin Boyd. John Michael Bailey, Eden, New South Wales, 2026.